Today's episode is brought to you by HelloFresh. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter SiriusPod30.
You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 134. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Well, a lot going on lately. I went to two events. I went to AACon. I had a great time. I also went to the Brew City Benefit in Milwaukee. I just want to say thanks to everybody who came out to both of those events and said hi. I had a great time. I'm not doing another event for a while, but when I am, I'll let you know. But it's been really fun to meet you guys, seriously. So thank you for coming out and supporting that. Speaking of AACon, there was a press release that David Silverman, who was on the show recently to promote AACon, was just suspended from American Atheists. There's no details yet as to why, but apparently there's an investigation. So we'll obviously have to withhold judgment until we get a hold of the facts. But that's definitely worrying and alarming. And I'm glad that American Atheists is taking it seriously. And I just wanted to let everybody know, since I've had him on the show recently, I'm going to be absolutely responsive to whatever the facts end up being. But for now, we don't have any of those. It's a very brief statement without any details. So that's all I can really say for now. All right, but in better news, today's episode is something that I think the skeptic movement can take a leadership role in, and that is educating people and moving society forward with regard to issues of science and clear thinking. And this is one of those issues. I'm deeply concerned about the environment and climate change. Very, very concerned about it. I just am so scared that we're not doing enough fast enough. And one thing, one component of it that I just think is getting such a short end of the stick and could really cost us as a society and actually the entire planet, really, is nuclear energy. So here to talk about that is Evan McDonnell. Evan's been someone who's listened to the show for a while, and we've been back and forth on this issue, and he's actually in the middle of pursuing a degree in chemical engineering with a focus on nuclear engineering, and this is an issue he's passionate about. And so I had him on to teach us some of the basics, answer some of the common questions on nuclear safety and what about solar and wind and all those kinds of things. Very reasonable questions to ask, of course. And here's Evan to teach us about nuclear and answer some of those questions. I'm joined by Evan McDonnell. How you doing, Evan?
I'm doing great today, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure.
This is a topic I've been interested in. I've done a little bit on it, but by no means an expert. But you are something of an expert, becoming an expert on nuclear power. Is that right?
That's right. Working towards my expertise there.
And this is one of those issues that gets cited sometimes as an instance of liberals not being really along with the science, as much as they could be. Is that your impression? What do you think?
It does seem to me that liberals get a little bit, as much as we like to try to be, the pro-science side of things, that this is a sort of misunderstood topic.
Yeah, yeah. What made you pursue a degree in this?
I think that nuclear power is a really important and fundamental part of sort of any energy policy that the world needs going forward, honestly. And so it seemed to fit really well in with my love of chemistry and my desire to affect change for environmental problems that we were looking at going forward.
Right. So it's kind of job security thing. You wanted to pick something where it seems like it should be part of the solution for the future to you.
Right. Exactly.
Oh, cool. So what do you think people are misunderstanding about nuclear energy? I mean, is it something we are not putting enough of an emphasis on? I mean, I hear that, you know, we don't build it hardly at all anymore, right?
That's true. In fact, we're currently decreasing the total number of nuclear reactors that are active in the United States right now. So we're going to lose sometime in the next about 5 years, another three nuclear reactors are going to go offline.
Why do you know the story of that specifically? Are they just outdated, or what is the reason we're losing three?
So it's a combination of a lot of different things that come together. Originally, a lot of these power plants were given 40-year leases, and a lot of those leases are coming up to be renewed right now. And in a lot of places, there's not a lot of public support for politicians to want to renew the leases in those areas. And so instead, they're being decommissioned.
Wow. Well, that's surprising, because I would think that, you know, the price of energy would be something that might be impacted by that, right? So wouldn't there be enough? Wouldn't it make sense to say, hey, we don't want to, if we're not getting it from nuclear power, we're going to have to make it up somewhere, and it's probably going to be something not as environmentally friendly.
And that's actually absolutely true. It goes back to a big misunderstanding about what things are the most environmentally friendly. At the same time, clashing with public perception. It seems to me that the way the public perceives energy sources is a big part of how we move forward in energy policy.
Yeah, it does seem, I mean, because there's the idiotic thing, you know, lately and within the past, I don't know, 5, 6, whenever it was, where all of a sudden clean coal was something. Like if you just put the word clean in front of it, then that meant, and of course, Trump thinks that means you take it out and then wash it, like give it a good
just
scrub.
Just give it a good scrub, yeah. And get everything nice and clean.
Yeah, I mean, is it that kind of thing where it's possibly more about some sort of marketing, or if not marketing, then just, you know, there are obviously some big, big reasons why people are wary of nuclear power. Do you think it's more of an image problem than the actual underlying substance?
I do think that the vast majority of public opposition is in a misunderstanding of exactly what the risks of using nuclear power are. That it seems that there's been a really consolidated anti-nuclear campaign founded in a lot of different areas, like concerns about proliferation of nuclear material and, you know, who has a bomb and those kinds of problems, compared to what is actually going on. So it seems to me that the risks have been played up to a really great extent, and that all these nuclear disasters that have happened in the past have really played into people's fears, in that they don't really understand exactly what's going on. That it seems to be something that people can take and really manipulate to their own ends in order to push their various agendas.
Right. I don't know of many right-wing arguments. The only argument I can think of, I could just be wrong, but the only arguments I think of are, you know, the kind of not in my backyard or, environmental arguments. Are there any other arguments that are coming from a different angle, or is that pretty much that assumption that it's going to hurt the environment or there's going to be an accident and kill a bunch of people?
So I think that's a really big part of it. But another argument that people bring up a lot is cost. And the fact that there needs to be some level of government subsidy in order to construct and operate nuclear power facilities, is that licensing and construction are very expensive. And there are not a lot of companies who are finding it as profitable to keep constructing, when we Republicans, especially conservatives, keep pushing things like saving coal jobs and trying to make coal as competitive as possible. And then on the left, people are trying to make solar and wind as competitive as possible. And, you know, those two extremes really have so many of their own issues that need to be addressed.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask that. Why do you think it's worth? Do you think it's a reasonable argument to say, okay, well, nuclear might be fine, but there seems to be some problems with how expensive it is or whatever, and so therefore we should put all our resources into wind or solar or something like that?
So the problem with wind and solar currently is they're not what are called base load energy sources currently, is that they can't maintain the base load of energy requirements as we currently need them in the United States, or anywhere for that matter. They have problems with intermittency, and they have problems with transmission. It's really great to say, oh, just build, you know, a big solar array out in the desert somewhere, except that then you have to transmit that power back to the East Coast in the United States. And that's not a problem that we have solved yet. Hmm. Is that storage capacity is really not where we need it to be yet for industrial scale uses, for things that are inherently intermittent power sources. So it's basically that we need something that can be built where people need the energy so that we can mitigate our transmission costs as best as possible while maintaining the base power that we need.
Okay, but is it the kind of thing, like, it seems like it's advancing, you know, all the time. Am I wrong on that? Is it reasonable to say, well, okay, we're not there yet, but we're going to be there soon enough to where it's the way of the future?
So it strikes me that we are not, I guess it strikes me that the problem of anthropogenic global warming is something that needs to be addressed right now. It's right. Not something that we can say like, well, in 5 years, yeah, you know, we're going to have some breakthrough in batteries. It's not something we can say in 10 years, you know, we're going to be able to build solar panels that have a high enough efficiency to overcome intermittency problems. Or, you know, something that we can say we'll be able to store all of our wind energy long enough in order to overcome that. It's something that needs to be addressed right now. And the only thing that currently has the ability to address those problems right now is nuclear energy.
Right. You know, I just actually Googled it up because I was curious of what we're getting, where we're getting our power currently. And it is striking that only 0.6% of our power in the U.S. is solar. So it really is not quite there yet.
Yes.
It looks like a third is coal, a third is natural gas, and right around 20% is nuclear. And then we got wind is actually 4.7%. Looks like there's a little more infrastructure there. But yeah, I guess we're a far cry from anything like a majority of our power being able to be, you know, created by wind and solar.
That's exactly right. It's really something that is just a little bit over the horizon before we can really make it the majority of our energy consumption.
I don't know that much about natural gas. Like, which is that in terms of what's polluting the environment and driving climate change? Do you know? Like, I mean, coal sounds bad. Natural gas, I actually have no idea. Like, how much carbon or whatever that involves. I mean, what is natural gas like?
So natural gas, it's not terrible, but any time that you're taking some sort of carbon-based fuel source and combusting it, you're going to end up with some emission of carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is one of our, you know, one of the greenhouse gases, and it's one of the biggest risks for global warming. So there have been a lot of advances in things like carbon capture and that kind of thing. And that's really what goes back to, like, clean coal is really like implementing carbon capture practices. But it's not a perfect system, is that there's still inherently some carbon dioxide release. And anytime you're combusting carbon-based fuels, you're always going to end up with carbon dioxide.
Well, then I guess that brings me to the straightforward, possibly stupid question of, can you explain how nuclear energy actually works, just to get our basics down?
Okay, so when we talk about power generation, aside from solar power, we're almost always talking about the ability to turn a turbine to make energy. Is that we spin the turbine, you get an electromagnetic field, and you can harness the electricity from that and transmit it wherever you need to. Hmm. So it's always been the question of, how do we turn a turbine? And so, you know, that's why wind energy works, is that wind goes over the blades and spin them, and you're turning a turbine. Or hydroelectric, you're running water over the turbine and you're turning it. But for things like coal and nuclear, the issue is heat generation. Hmm. So you're creating a lot of heat in order to convert water into steam, and using that steam at high pressure to turn your turbine.
Hmm.
And when you're talking about heat generation, combustion creates a lot of heat. That's why your engine gets really hot when you drive your gasoline car. It's how steam engines have worked for, you know, 100
years. Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds so old-fashioned. You're just getting water hot and then steam turns something. I didn't know it was that old-fashioned for nuclear.
It really is the next step of the same fundamental principle. So what it comes down to then in the race between using something like coal or natural gas versus using something like uranium, it's how energy dense your material is. And the difference between coal and nuclear is that nuclear fuel is about 10,000 times as energy dense as coal is.
Hmm.
So you really only need a very small amount of material to create enough heat. And then you just put water through that core and turn it to steam, and you can turn your turbine. The basic way then that we create that heat in a nuclear reactor is by the process of nuclear fission, which is we have some isotope in the currently everywhere. Everything that everyone uses is that we use an isotope called uranium-235.
Right.
That's what we call a fissile material, which means that when it's bombarded with neutrons, which are part of the fundamental building blocks, is one of the fundamental building blocks of the nucleus of an atom. Neutrons impact the nucleus of the uranium-235 atom, and it splits apart. It creates fission products and a whole lot of heat. So it actually all goes back, really interestingly, to the famous Einstein equation, E equals mc squared,
mm-hmm.
where you're converting the mass of the uranium-235 atom. And when it splits apart, you're losing some amount of mass. And that's converted into the energy that we use to
heat and then for some reason you get to multiply like the speed of light involved, and then it creates a tremendous amount of energy.
I don't know how
that works, but you get to just decide. And wait, it's mc squared too. C squared.
Yeah, that's you get crazy. To square the speed of light, which wow. is even better. Really, no wonder really there's so much energy. Fantastic.
It really is a crazy thing to think about. I don't know what that's an insane amount of energy.
That's the thing, is that it really is an absurd amount of energy that you get for every atom that fissions. So we take that U-235 and convert some portion of its mass into energy, boil water that goes through it, and that's what turns our turbines.
Simple as that, huh? So what are the challenges? Is it, I mean, you always hear about meltdown and that sort of thing. Is it just containing all of it in a safe way? That's the biggest challenge?
That really is a big part of the challenge. At this point, the biggest challenge to building our most efficient nuclear reactors is a materials problem, is that the materials that we build the core out of, that we hold the fuel in, is also bombarded with the same neutrons as they spray out during all the fission events. And the activation of those, what we call activation, which is that neutron bombardment, is actually can be really detrimental to those materials, and that we can only keep any given fuel assembly in a core for a fairly short amount of time at this point.
What kind of time are we talking?
Something on the order of 6 months.
Oh, wow. So is that the kind of thing where okay, first, a basic question. What does it mean for something to be radioactive? What does that mean exactly?
All right. So radioactivity is the emission of energy in the form of various different types of particles from the nucleus or the orbiting electrons of an atom. So radioactivity is specifically refers to releasing of some sort of particle from the atom, which causes that atom to turn into a different atom of another element. So, for example, uranium decays by alpha emission, which is basically releasing an entire helium atom from the nucleus of that atom. And so that uranium 238 becomes thorium 234 after that emission.
Well, just to ask the dumb question, like I think radioactive bad, you know, that harms us, can kill you. But that, the way you just described it, sound like, oh, it's just giving off helium. Why is that a stupid thing to say? What is it actually doing?
So it's really a function of what type of the radiation that's being given off. So for the example we were talking about with throwing off a helium atom, is that's really not dangerous for an external exposure, because those alpha particles are attenuated almost entirely by something like an inch or two of air.
Interesting.
So if you're more than an inch away from something giving off that alpha radiation, you're basically completely protected from it.
Oh, okay. So that's not the kind of thing that's the hazard suit and all that. How does it become dangerous then?
So there are other types of emissions. So we have beta emission, which is basically an electron or its antiparticle, a positron, being emitted. And those have a little bit more of a penetrating power, and they have they travel a little faster, and they have a little bit more energy. And so it's something that you need to consider. But again, they can be blocked by a little bit of glass or, you know, anything like that. If you have, you know, a thin sheet of metal in between you and it, you'll never even feel any of those particles. And then we have gamma radiation, which are high energy photons. So the same fundamental particles as light, but much higher energy. And those have a lot more of the penetrating power. Uh-huh. And can interact a lot more from an external dose inside a person's body.
Okay. So that, I mean, I know you're probably not a doctor or anything, but like that just messes with our atoms in a way that sounds bad.
Yeah, it's something that can come in and can interact with atoms, like in people's DNA, and that's where you can see some small amounts of cellular damage and things like that. So we have a whole area of the field called health physics, which basically deals with how radiation impacts people's metabolism and things like that.
Interesting.
And then the final kind of radiation that we usually worry about is the neutron radiation, which is a lot of what you get when you're doing this nuclear fission, because neutrons are what we need in order to propagate a fission event. So you need a lot of neutrons to be flung out from each fission so that they impact more of the atoms and can create more fission events.
Okay.
And neutrons tend to be really high energy and tend to travel through materials pretty well. And that's what we really need to shield against when we're talking about building nuclear reactors.
Okay. So you were talking about the containment materials kind of, and you have to change them out in a period of months. Is that when we talk about like where we're dumping nuclear waste, like where we're putting this stuff? Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's a really big part of what we talk about with nuclear waste. Basically, we end up with lots of different types of nuclear waste when we're talking about waste. So we have activation product we were talking about with the fuel assemblies and with some of the atoms that were in the fuel but were not being directly fissioned. And things like the water that we send through to boil, that can be an activation product. And so we usually keep that in a separate closed loop so that we can not worry about it too much. And at the same time, we have the fission products from the fuel itself, which are the fragments that are flung off from the fission. So every time it fissions, you know, it splits near about in half, and you end up with two new atoms, which are often radioactive themselves. Mm-hmm. So a big part, I think, of the misunderstanding of the dangers of nuclear power is in how dangerous the fuel is and how we should be handling that spent fuel that we create.
Hey folks, I've got to interrupt this interview to talk about HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. They've got a great selection, and I love this. I may need this very soon with little Phoebe. You can make family dinners fuss-free by using HelloFresh's Picky Eater kid-tested and approved family plan recipes. I've talked about how fun it is to cook HelloFresh, but here's a new thing I'm really interested in. Global Eats. This option brings authentic international dishes and flavors to home cooks for exciting new meals. I love that HelloFresh helps you try new things that you just wouldn't think to try yourself. But even though you're cooking new and different things, you won't spend all night in the kitchen because the recipes only take around 30 minutes. And as always, the bottom line for me in this is that you have to spend less time meal planning and grocery shopping each week, and you get more of that time back. Time is very precious to me with all that I'm trying to do, and I'm sure it is to you as well. And I hate food waste. I love that they give you exactly the ingredients you need in exactly the proportions you need. It's very satisfying. So just this past week, we had our friends over and we made the crushed peppercorn steak with cream kale and potato wedges. And it was exactly as good as it sounds. It was delicious and it only took 30 minutes. I really think you should give it a try. And if you'd like to, go to HelloFresh.com, get $30 off your first week by using promo code SiriusPod30. That's $30 off your first week. Try it out. HelloFresh.com, SiriusPod30. All right, and now back to the interview. I remember there's a John Oliver segment on something about to do with this. Like there was some nuclear waste that wasn't being managed properly. But why is that something that ultimately, I mean, while obviously it's a worry and it's something you have to deal with, for you, it's ultimately not a reason to move away from nuclear power.
The main thing is that I think that while it's true that this spent nuclear fuel and the waste that we get from nuclear energy in total is a dangerous material, and it is something that we need to worry about, it is ultimately a solvable problem. Is that we have different techniques that we can employ that we just currently aren't using in the United States that could significantly mitigate the risks.
So like what? We're not using
it? So there are two basic ways that you can deal with the spent fuel.
Yeah, first is you bury it near a town water supply and just hope for the best, right? Is that?
That's exactly right. No, in fact, what we want to do ultimately with all these problems is what's called a deep geological repository, which is where we want to find somewhere that is basically deep underground and is in a geologic formation that is itself a part of the containment for it. So we have started construction in a couple of places. One of them, most famously, is the Yucca Mountain facility, where the idea is that it's a giant natural salt formation. Hmm. And that salt formations like that are a self-healing formation, so that even if cracks do form in the salt, that the nature of salt is that it will close off those cracks. And it, even in the event of some sort of leak or something like that, that the movement of the material through the nuclear material through the ground is so slow that by the time it would reach any sort of groundwater supply, we would be looking at all of the radioactive material having decayed to a natural background radiation level.
Oh, really? It's that. So I was going to ask that, like how long, because I thought this stuff stays nuclear for, you know, when you think in terms of, sorry, I have like 10 questions I'm trying to get.
No, sorry, absolutely.
First off, and this is in Nevada, so that's fine with me. I mean, we just put it on the ground there. I don't even care. You don't even have to bury it.
Right. Nevada. Yeah, I mean,
just get rid of most of it
anyway.
Yeah.
So.
there's no, nobody's there. It's okay. No. But when it comes to burying something like that, you know, it does sound like to my non-expert ears, it sounds like, okay, you're just burying your problem for a minute until, you know, 10, 20, 50 years from now, you've got a ton of this stuff and then you've just buried it. And then ultimately there's going to be a problem, but does it not have like a thousands of years half-life or what?
So it does have not just thousands, in fact, but tens of thousands
okay.
of years half-life for some of these products. But things that have very long half-lives don't actually emit that much radiation. So they tend to have a low, what we call activity, which is the actual number of radioactive particles that it gives off. So things like uranium have a half-life for different isotopes on the order of 10,000 to 100,000 to a million years.
Wow.
But that being the case, that means that not very many of their particles are actually spontaneously giving off.
So it is as simple as if you're giving off a ton, then your half-life is shorter because you're giving off a ton. Like it is that is as simple as that. Like it's kind of proportional to how much you're giving off, or inversely, I guess.
That is a big part of it, and of course, a lot of things decay into other products that also give off radiation, and so it's this what we call a decay chain until it reaches a stable state.
Gotcha.
And those can be very, very long. But the vast majority of the actual activity in the spent nuclear fuel tends to come from things that have much shorter half-lives, on the order of 30 to 50 years. So things like your cesium-137, or your cobalt-60, or other things like that, tend to have much shorter half-lives, certainly on a geological scale. And so they will decay to much lower levels much more quickly. And so you're looking at something like 100 to 200 years before the long-lived actinide materials.
So in 200 years, you could dig it up and put it in your stew and you'll be fine.
I would definitely not recommend that. But it is something that needs to be somewhere that we leave it alone for,
like Nevada,
as long as possible. So Nevada is perfect, basically. And Texas has been in talks a lot, actually, for a geologic repository as well.
So, but you said, just to clear it up, you said we weren't using some of these things in the U.S. What did you mean by that specifically?
So that's exactly the problem, is that we started building this repository in Yucca Mountain and then stopped and have never shipped any of our spent nuclear fuel there.
Okay.
So basically the problem is that there are a number of sites that handle nuclear waste, but for the most part, the reactors themselves are having to store all of their spent fuel at this point.
Oh, because we have, because, so what, why didn't we put any of our stuff in Yucca Mountain? Was it one of those?
It's basically an issue of political will, of the not in my backyard idea of the people of Nevada saying that they're not, they don't want to have all this shipped there. And I think it's a big part of it is succumbing to that kind of political pressure.
Okay.
And not understanding the way in which those sort of repositories actually make the problem of spent nuclear fuel significantly less of a problem.
Okay.
So our best way of mitigating it is to put it here, but people are more concerned with their own fear, basically, about it.
Okay. So that is that a reason why some of these plants are shutting down, or is that unrelated?
I think that's an unrelated problem. Okay. I think that those are, so those it's not, are more it's not about as though not wanting we're so to have jammed.
So what, in terms of storing the stuff in the actual plant, because that, when you said that, it kind of sounded alarming, but is it something that we're not like at any sort of capacity yet, or how's that work?
No, we're really not at any kind of capacity. So it's another thing that a lot of people don't understand is how much of this sort of high activity, most dangerous waste is produced.
Yeah.
So if any given person had all of their energy from nuclear fuel for their entire lives, the amount of this high activity waste that would be produced is about 12 ounces. Okay. That would be for your entire lifetime usage.
Wow.
Of all electricity. It's not a high volume. It's a high activity. The higher volume are a lot of the other kinds of your various nuclear wastes, which tend to be things like the gloves people were wearing while they were working on some sort of problem, which also, you know, is something that we want to deal with, but which isn't producing a lot of this sort of dangerous activity. It's just something that we need to hold on to for 5 or 10 years.
There's just germs on it. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it's things that get like a little bit contaminated. They get a little bit. Contamination is just having like a little bit of nuclear material or like radioactive material actually physically on it. So like if you rubbed your finger on some uranium, that you could get a little bit of uranium on your finger, and then that would be contamination. So things are contaminated, and which are going to be much lower activity and not present nearly the same kind of long-term problems.
Okay, but it's still something like you want in Nevada. It's just not as dangerous.
We actually have a lot of storage facilities for that kind of waste. Okay. There's a lot of that kind of waste produced in lots of other capacities. So like medical isotopes, after they get used, need to be shipped somewhere to be stored, but they're also tend to be very short-lived. So it's all these sort of short-lived, short-term storage problems. There are a number of different sites around the country that handle that kind of material.
What gives here? I mean, it sounds like it's expensive. I'm seeing, things I look at that, it does cost a lot. And is that all a result of actual cost? Is it regulation? Is it both? What do you think?
The biggest impediment in terms of cost is absolutely regulation, but that's not to say that this isn't something that
might be good
regulated.
Regulation. Yeah.
This is absolutely something that we need, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to be in charge of, and that it is very important. So a big part of these sort of costs are in developing new types of reactors, the next generation of reactors. So we have most of the reactors in the country are aging a lot, which doesn't make them less safe because they are actually designed for very long lives. But we are talking about reactors that are 50 or 60 years old at this point, and that we are looking to build new generations of nuclear power plants, but that the design process is very long for those sort of things, in a large part because of all of the regulations that we need to meet in order to ensure the safety of those new types of reactors.
So it sounds like there's a lot that goes into, I mean, when it already sounds like people are kind of negative on nuclear power in general. And so it's, is it a, just a question of a lot of factors of maybe people don't want to invest that time and money into trying to design or invent something new and build something new. And it's just kind of a culminates in we're just not building any more of them.
That's basically exactly right. Mm. Is that without the political will to make it so that we can build those reactors, build new reactors, and especially next generation reactors, that it really becomes too difficult for private companies to want to stay in the nuclear industry, basically. That it becomes easier to say, like, oh, well, we'll just build a new coal plant because that doesn't take, nearly as much regulation to get through. And it seems to be in their short-term financial best interest, essentially. Right.
Oh, man. So the coal jobs are coming back, is what you're saying?
I don't see any way in which coal jobs are sustainable in the long term. And that's a big part of the problem, I think, is this idea that we can save all these coal jobs when, coal is a very finite resource. And we're not sure exactly how much longer we have, for things like that, and how long we can continue using it at that rate. Whereas, we know what kind of stockpile of, uranium we're looking at, or what kinds of, there are other possible fuels that we could use for nuclear reactions that we haven't even considered using in the US or anywhere in the world at this point. Thorium-233 reactors, molten salt reactors, and other kinds of like next generation reactors that are not getting a lot of serious consideration, mainly because nobody is mining any thorium because there's no call for it.
Hmm.
So there's, we get a little bit of thorium mined from other kinds of heavy metal mines, that we get a little bit of thorium out of it, but that on the whole, there's no financial incentive to mine thorium, despite the fact that it's more abundant in the Earth's crust than lead is.
Oh, wow. Are there any countries that you think are doing nuclear right? I mean, is it anywhere in the world that people are building plants? Or because you always see when we're looking at renewable energy, it seems like the U.S. is not necessarily leading the way on that. What about nuclear?
It's actually really interesting. One of the biggest markets for building new nuclear plants right now is actually China.
Hmm.
That China is on track to build some of the first next-gen nuclear power plants they should be opening up in the next couple of years. And that they're building something like 30 to 50 new nuclear power plants in the next 20 years or so. China is really becoming a world leader in nuclear energy right now. And also India has been building a lot of new nuclear facilities, not quite on the same magnitude as China.
Right. But both very populated places that need a lot of energy and growing places as well. So it makes sense. They have a ton of energy needs.
Yes. And they're quickly realizing, it seems to me, that nuclear is a really great way to meet those energy needs.
Yeah. And not pollute necessarily Yeah.
Yeah. It really gives them a lot of advantage as sort of energy leaders in the world, as they can, point to their clean energy production. Nuclear energy is one of the lowest carbon intensive forms of energy. It's actually significantly less carbon intensive than either wind or solar.
Oh, really? Energy. How does that work?
So the production of solar panels and the production of the parts needed for wind farms actually uses a lot of carbon in their manufacturing, is that you end up in using manufacturing facilities that require a lot of, carbon intensive work, that they get their energy from coal sources or natural gas sources, and that the mining facilities for those tend to be much more carbon intensive.
Right. I mean, but wouldn't some of the same stuff apply if you're building a nuclear power plant? You're going to use some carbon energy to do that, right?
It's true. I mean, you're necessarily going to use some, but it's still ranked significantly less than either of those, by orders of magnitude less, actually. Then one of the only things that are less carbon intensive are like geothermal energy, which is very situational.
This must be like per unit produced over the lifetime, or per, how do you know how they figure that?
It is also a function of how much energy they can supply.
Okay.
To by kilowatt hour, it's the carbon intensity of nuclear fuel is next to nothing.
So in trying to draw to a close here and summing up, I mean, what should we be doing? I mean, are there any organizations you think are good on this? Is there any measures, is it politically, that we should be taking, or just trying to increase awareness that this is a good way to go for climate change purposes?
There are some, although not particularly many, organizations who do this kind of work, trying to get the idea about nuclear power out. I think that it really needs to be sort of a grassroots movement where we need to be contacting legislators and asking them to invest in nuclear energy instead of investing in solutions that don't provide the amount of the kind of energy that we need as a society. So, you know, that investing money in research for renewable energy sources is really, really important, but that research isn't offering us a solution right now, and that we need a solution right now. And so it really comes down to contacting, you know, your representatives and your senators and trying to vote for people with positive energy policy, people who are willing to use nuclear power as part of their energy portfolio for the country.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tough one. It's just not, doesn't seem like it's that politically smart of a thing right now to say, yes, nuclear. Like, it just seems to have a bit of a stigma attached to it. So I guess doing work to try to reduce that stigma may help, but it's one of those long-term battles.
It's really a public perception campaign.
Right.
Is that we need to spread public awareness to, you know, about what nuclear can do for us and combat the sort of anti-science narrative that, you know, the Fukushima Daiichi disaster irradiated the entire ocean. And when you see those, you know, graphics that show the, you know, all the radiation from there spreading out throughout the water and say, well, actually that was just a graph of, you know, that was a graphic of ocean currents and had nothing to do at all with how the radiation had spread from there.
Yeah, there's a lot of fake news involved in that disaster, right?
Yes, I really think there's an obscene amount of fake news around that disaster. It's really been a focal point of sort of that anti-nuclear movement. And it's really been very detrimental, despite the fact that there was, you know, no loss of life reported from the disaster itself, and that there's been studies that show there's no increased cancer rates at all among the affected people, and that it's really something that people are not.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's always plenty more we could talk about, but I think in the meantime, it has been something that I've a position I've had that I think we ought to do more with nuclear. I also think we seem to be still subsidizing really shitty forms of, you know, energy. I don't know why. And it's like, nuclear might be expensive, but we're also subsidizing coal and subsidizing oil and stuff. And I think if you take that into account, if we could just really focus into subsidizing better forms of energy, that would do a lot.
That would be a huge, huge difference. If we could work on subsidizing forms of energy that are not so, you know, environmentally destructive, and then retrain people to work in that industry instead, so we're not losing, you know, sort of this job creation.
Yeah, we're probably losing jobs. 30 or 40 coal jobs in the entire country that we need to make sure we don't. God forbid we lay off 75 coal workers in the U.S. or something like that. But yeah, no, sorry, go ahead.
No, you know, just once we transition into, you know, it's anyone who works in a coal plant can move and work in a, you know, nuclear plant with just, you know, a little bit of training.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's not magic that's happening. It's just, you know, other jobs that people can be, you know, taking over instead.
Right. Well, Evan, thanks so much for joining me. And is there anywhere you want to point people online or anything? Or are you just content to try to educate people on nuclear policy a little bit?
It's really just my pleasure to be able to, you know, talk about something that is really a passion of mine.
Well, excellent. I appreciate it a lot. I enjoyed it. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
So I was inspired by this recording to do a little more research. There's some great TED Talks on this. And I think one thing that people really don't have a handle on, and I would include myself prior to, you know, educating myself on it, is how the nuclear disasters really happened and what the casualties really were and why. Everyone thinks about Fukushima, and we touched on it. There's a lot of fake news. People died. It was horrific. But most of the deaths, actually, if not the vast, vast majority of them, were because of the decisions made by the government in how evacuation would take place. And rather than sit tight and try to shelter in place, which is what in retrospect should have been done, that people attempted to evacuate lots of elderly and people who needed hospice care, that kind of thing. And that was what most of the deaths were. Also in these TED Talks that I've watched, and of course there's also sources in those talks because, you know, to be skeptical of everything, those talks can sometimes be BS. But if you follow up, it turns out that radiation, we get a lot more of it from other things than we would ever get from some of these disasters, and so much more radiation as a result of nuclear testing back in the 60s, that sort of thing. So lots of ways to put these things into perspective. Doesn't mean nuclear is completely safe, of course, but nothing is. And what I think the key perspective, the thing that I've really learned and that's made me wish we could do better on nuclear and that we're actually actively building nuclear power plants rather than shutting them down, is how many lives are saved. You don't really factor that in. I mean, air pollution costs millions of lives. Climate change could be catastrophic. It's definitely going to cost lives. That's the sort of thing we don't factor in when we talk about nuclear, just how much better it is for our air quality. And that's a very real factor. As much as I think we all wish that wind and solar were ready for us to just use, it's just not there. And it's going to take a long time for it to be a significant source of our energy. And nuclear is here now, and it can be safe, and it costs zero pollution once it's running, of course. I mean, there is some cost. You got to be accurate in factoring in all the costs of building the plants, and there is some. But over the life of the power, it's so much cleaner than what we're doing now. And we need that, you know, the environment needs it. And it's something that I just don't think enough people are talking about. And in fact, the latest data on that I'm finding, and I wish there were more, but I'm not finding good polls on this. But as of 2016, Gallup posted an article indicating that for the first time in history, a majority of Americans opposed nuclear energy. Now, there's some other sources that say it might not be that way. It might have been how the questions were asked, but you can see the trend line regardless. It's not good either way. I mean, maybe you could argue methodology on some of it, but you can see a clear trend downward. Before Fukushima, it was trending steadily upward. And then after that, it really did take a toll on people's perceptions. And it's unfortunate. I know a lot of people care a lot about this issue. I'm curious if you're someone who disagrees, if you think we shouldn't be pursuing nuclear. I'd love to hear counter arguments because I think this is a pretty solid case. I think there's more information out there. So, email me, voicemail, whatever, if you disagree. I'd love to hear your arguments and kind of look further into it, because I think it's a really important issue. It's one we should be talking about more either way, because the environment is, you know, especially with what Pruitt and what Trump has done to the EPA, I mean, I'm very concerned. So I think this is a key step to reducing global warming, to fighting climate change. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Quick note to my patrons. I had promised a bonus episode. Well, the travel took a serious toll on me. The last 2 weeks of travel have just been kind of a nightmare. I often don't factor in just how exhausting it is and how much I have to catch up on. So I wasn't able to do that. And then also Phoebe got sick, and that ruins everything, because then I have to watch her, and it's very difficult to do anything while you're watching an infant. Daycare is awesome until Phoebe is sick, which happens seemingly at least once a month. And that's very frustrating. But I have a guarantee I will absolutely have two bonus patron only episodes per month at a minimum. That will happen. I will get those in. And I am going to talk about, I'm really excited to talk about the article about atheists moving toward the alt-right. I think you'd be surprised on what I have to say to that. Well, I'll leave it there. That's the bonus episode I intend to do. I'll have it out very soon. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for people supporting at patreon.com/seriouspod or seriouspod.com/support. Either way, thank you a ton. I hope you'll enjoy the bonus episode when I do get it out, and I'll be more prompt when I'm not traveling all the time. All right. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next week.